Just sort this out here a little. New Zealand, nearly right, sir. But we forgive mistakes like that. New Zealand is a country with 30 million sheep and 3 million people. That's hard to tell the difference. And they have jokes like that about us too. So I can't be totally unfair. Alright, we're nearly there. By the way, when was the last time you heard a gorilla band play music that well? Because, you see, you and I live in a world in which many people think we're just overbrained, less hairy cousins of orangutans and gorillas, and we're so like them, where must they come from? But in reality, they don't make choirs, they don't sing, they don't go to church, they don't have meetings discussing where the people come from. And tonight and tomorrow, we'll be dealing with the issue of the 6 days of creation. We're going to touch on dinosaurs, we're going to touch on Brian Cox, we're going to touch on worms and bugs and germs and all sorts of interesting things. And if you come to the church and you're free tomorrow, in the morning particularly, if you're not, you've got your own church, you go there in the morning. But you're welcome back tomorrow night as we deal with a fun, spectacular one on dinosaurs. You'll notice we have a website, creationresearch.net, and there's lots of questions you can ask. You'll have a question time tonight, but if you don't get your question answered, there's hundreds of questions on the Q&A site. I've been down over the past couple of weeks with AIG at their Birmingham conference, and even though we're separate from AIG, and I believe Philip Bell from CMI is coming up here, and that's another organisation, but we're Creation Research, and I'd encourage you to actually go onto the website or sign up the back for some fabulous free electronic newsletters. Also up the back you will see DVDs. We major in DVDs. That one actually came out of a program that I did on Art Talk in the BBC show, where the compere said, "Hey, we're so like apes and monkeys and gorillas, we must have come from them. What's your evidence we were created?" And I said, "I've never been asked that question by a gorilla." He didn't know how to react to that until finally he smiled. He could have cried, but monkeys don't, you see. It's interesting. On the front of that DVD, I put that the differences between men and monkeys, apes and gorillas and chimpanzees are so great, you have to be trained at university to miss them. It's really true. Up the back, you'll see a new DVD since I was here 3 years ago. Professor Andy McIntosh, who's the head professor of engineering research at Leeds University, and I team up to do work, and that's a great DVD if you're looking for the evidence of how clever God the Creator is. If you are not coming tomorrow night and you want to have a look at the subjects anyway, we only have one of that trilogy left, and you'll get to see quite a bit of that if you pick up the DVD set. But the good news is, even for the ones we've run out, because this is my last series of meetings in the UK, my darling wife is waiting for me desperately to be airmailed home on Thursday, and I'm looking forward to being warm again. I've been up in Scotland. I drove for several hours through a snowstorm yesterday down from the Highlands, and I was cold, and I discovered one thing. iPhones don't work at 0 degrees. They absolutely free, solid stuff. You couldn't use an emergency at all. It was amazing. And the battery just dies. Quite amazing. Okay, all of these, even if we don't have them up the back, are actually available as MP4s or on our web shop. Perhaps I'd better introduce them tonight, because Brian Cox wrote a book. You know, it's popular, Brian, on the BBC. And it was all about how to make a universe. And his whole thesis is, given long enough, matter could organise itself into galaxies and planets and people, including himself. Okay, at the other side of the stick, you have Creation Research. We already have one museum here in the UK. We're setting up a second one. The one in Norfolk is now open and available. The one in Wales should be done in about 2 years' time. There's a big building being put up over there. And a lot of it's to do with our next worker here in the UK, a young guy called Joseph. You'll hear a bit more about him over the weekend. By the way, he's on side because he's got a fossil crocodile. Come on, you don't have one, do you? You see, that's one reason why he doesn't believe in evolution. It's the same reason I rejected evolution. Fossil crocodiles are easy to recognise. They just look like they're crocodiles. And there isn't any evidence to the contrary. Joseph is a geology student, and he does some fabulous work out collecting specimens for our museum. And to pay his way to university, he's a part-time zookeeper. So he's getting plenty of experience running tour groups and handling animals and talking to people with strange lizards on his head. They seem to have an affinity for his brains. And he does a great job, and he's got a lovely family too. But more importantly, in terms of our museum, he goes places where you and I wouldn't think of going. Like, can you spot him yet? Here he is on a dinosaur dig on the Isle of Wight. Joseph actually is out after all sorts of interesting fossils. Fossil dinosaur footprints by the gazillion down there in the Isle of Wight. You can go there when the tide's really low. And I'll guarantee you don't have one of these either. Well, Joseph doesn't yet either. But I would really like to put one of these in our museum here in the UK. Joseph goes out and collects lots of fossils for us in all sorts of weather. And I've been taking him out this year, and just under the Severn Bridge, you'd be amazed. We spent 3 days under the bridge. I know that's like camping out in public, so almost nobody goes down there. But we came home with dinosaur teeth, dinosaur rib cages, and all sorts of those plesiosaurs and the cattles. Quite amazing, actually. And you have a chance of seeing them over in our Norfolk Museum or in the one in Wales. And if you're interested in supporting what Creation Research does here in the UK, then one of our trust members is up the back. He's the guy with the big hairy face. That's Mr. Ed. He's right up the back row. But you can talk to us about helping those projects. We've got gift aid available through our trust here. Okay, let's ask that question. Because Mr. Cox's answer would be different from mine. Some of you probably don't even know what hydrogen is, except you put it in balloons and they float away. According to Professor Cox, hydrogen is a colourless, odourless gas that, given long enough, turns into professors, and no one knows the reason why. You see, hydrogen is what Professor Cox used to be. And he believes in nothing eternal before or after that's outside the physical. Now, I'm a Christian. I make no apologies for that. I used to lecture in geology, hence my interest in dinosaurs and things like that. But I also got sidetracked in this issue because I do a lot of debates and people say, well, you can see that things could happen all by themselves. I also find that someone who's done a lot of digging and research, there's an interesting verse in the Bible that says that. Test everything, only keep the things that turn out to be good or true. Now, you would think that's out of a scientist manual. It's actually out of the New Testament. And it's a good rule for politics. I mean, how's Theresa May passing your test at the moment? How's the Treasury going? And how about the high school curriculum? Are you testing everything? Because I think that's brilliant advice, whether you're a scientist, a politician, or a theologian, or whatever. So when people ask me, listen, why did you believe in creation like the host of Heart Talk did? My first question then is, hey, what do you know about it? You see, the Bible says, in the beginning, nothing got here by itself. Neither hydrogen, nor even the space. God made everything, and it says 10 times in Genesis 1 that God created things to produce their own kind. Of course, the thing that challenged me as a geology student was, if that's true, what would the evidence be? Because you see, Cox and Alice Roberts, David Attenborough, the BBC, have a story that says molecules didn't produce their own kind. Amoebas turned into fishes that grew legs and turned into dinosaurs that grew feathers and turned into birds. And how do you test that? Because you see, Charles Darwin was the first person who thought of a way to test the biblical position. And most people think he successfully proved it wrong. But I wonder whether he did or he didn't. You see, here's what the Bible says about simple things like flowers. God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its seed kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth, and it was so, and the evening and the morning were the third day. I mean, I'm a gardener. I would love to be able to make gardens like that. How about you? Come on, cauliflowers, move. Come on, Macanese, hurry up there. I mean, that's spectacular. I can understand why people struggle with that, because you and I take a long time to achieve anything like that. And the biblical picture is, no, time wasn't needed. Process was what mattered. Then God said, let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures that birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament. So God created these six, and the evening and morning were the fifth day. While flowers on day three, birds and flying things that can pollinate them on day five. Hey, guys, your brain in function? The theory of evolution says seaweed somehow evolved onto the land, somehow turned into flowering plants, or some of it got sidetracked and turned into insects. Fortunately, they were here pretty much at the same time, or they both would have died out. You see, God created the world very good, and very good is, well, you and I think of those terms as moral, but the interesting thing is, in Genesis, good is way beyond moral. Good is that the lion lay down with the lamb and they both ate grass just like the ox. There was no death or destruction in all of God's holy kingdom. Now, I say that because, you see, having come from a university situation where the professor at the department said, just say God used millions of years of evolution. The trouble was, it's impossible to fit that view into Genesis. Because Genesis has no death or destruction. And Brian Cox's view says the dinosaurs died out. We bumped off the ape man. We evolved, killed or be killed. There's a stumbling block. The Bible says it didn't take millions of years. It didn't even take 6,000 years. He did it all in 6 days. Now, over the next couple of days, you're going to have an opportunity to ask all sorts of questions about that. But here's how I'm going to help you tonight. What do you need to make work? I mean, isn't it? You've never thought of that question, right? Now, one thing I've observed, if you want to get involved in science or engineering and in industry and be successful, there's millions of pounds to be made in questions that haven't been asked, particularly if you can find the answers. I mean, what do you need to make a worm? Let's help you. There's a worm. Some of you boys are familiar with worms. Remember when you drop them down the back of your sister's skirt? Worms are holy creatures, don't they dig holes? No, they actually don't. The worm is a portable hole. It eats the dirt at one end, passes it through, gets all the food out, fills up the tunnel at the other end. Amazing creatures. Slimy though, aren't they? Interesting thing, worms. Of course, my dad was a gardener too, and one of the things I learned early was that if you want to have a good garden, guess what you need in the soil? Worms. But here's the dilemma. You see, the theory of evolution says hydrogen, all by itself, step by step, over the billions of years, turned into you and I and the universe, and earthworms on the way. The funny thing is, though, unless you have plants, the worms have got nothing to eat. But unless you have the worms, the plants can't get anywhere either. Unless you have the bacteria in the worm's guts, it can't even digest the plants. You see, in order to have worms, you have to already have some sort of a garden. Actually, you can go on a bit further. In order to have the plants, what else do you need? You see, I'm doing this deliberately because most of us think Lego block. You know, step by step by step. And we never ask where the Lego blocks come from. And we don't ask what you need to get a Lego block. So let me help you. Here's worms. Amazing. They do it sort of funny, don't they? Head to tail. Because you see, he is actually he and she. No such thing as transgender at all with worms. They're male and female on the one body. I bring that up because you see, when I was a student at university, the feminists were into saying, let's look at nature and copy our rules for sex from nature. And I scratched my head and I thought, well, I'm doing all right without borrowing any ideas from nature. And they said, we think the rules for sex should be borrowed from spiders or praying mantises. Why? Because when they mate it, she bites his head off. Okay. I said, no, I want to pick the big stallion because when he's mated, he puts her in her place. But you end up with no rules that way. Oh, the worms mate and they produce these things. Come on, be honest, you've never seen worm eggs, have you? It's interesting what happens out there that you don't actually see. And neither do you see baby worms. No one's interested in baby worms, but they start out as babies. And some of them grow real big. Like in Australia, we have worms that are 10 feet or 3 metres long. You go fishing with one of those, you catch a blue whale. But you see, the question I'm asking you is to make you think. Now, I could get out here and tell you everything about what to think, because that's what my university lectures did to me, and I must admit, I was disappointed. I wanted to learn how to think, not what to think. Okay, what do you need to make a worm? Perhaps I'll help you a little bit here. You see, let's imagine you needed to toast or make a piece of toast. What would you actually need? And you'll say, toaster, sir. Oh, very good. What do you need to make a toaster? You see, the average person just goes to Asda or whatever, picks up a toaster and comes home, and never joins the dots. Okay, to make a toaster, don't you need someone to open the electric generator? Yes, you make the electric generator, but that doesn't work unless you connect the electric generator all the way to the toaster, agree? Plug it in. So you have to have an electricity company. And in order for that to work, you have to design the toaster so you can actually open it and put the slice of bread in, agree? And then you have to have it so it doesn't burn out on the first go. I mean, you've got to get some value out of this toaster. Have you begun to join the dots yet? Oh, to have the generator to work, don't you actually need some fuel to run it on? If you're going to run it on coal power, don't you actually need someone to invent a metal so you can dig a hole in the ground? Then in order to get the coal, don't you have a geologist who goes and finds it? Isn't this getting an expensive toaster? It's amazing, really. Of course, in order for the toaster to work, don't you actually need some bread? I mean, what's the point of a toaster? Where'd you get the bread from? You say, I got it from Littles. No. They got it from the man who made it, who got it from the guy who makes flour, who got the flour from the farmer, who plants the wheat that needs the worm. Oh, and all of a sudden, the story is getting bigger and bigger. And we haven't even asked where your house is, correct? I mean, who's going to stand outside in the snow toasting a slice of bread? This is getting amazing. In fact, soil, plants, water. You could make this list longer and longer and longer if you start to think about it. Let's help you a bit further. Let's go to Kangaroo Island, off the coast of Australia. I go down there every year or so. Guess why it's called Kangaroo Island? Kangaroos, very good. Miniature ones, aren't they cute? And I love going to Kangaroo Island, particularly because of that jetty. Two-thirds of the way along, you should have seen the fish that I nearly caught. Although I still have bragging rights. You see, last year I went fishing, and look at that. Now that's a fish. But I wasn't going there just to fish. I go there to collect fossils. Do you see this fossil worm? This fossil worm is supposed to be 500 and something million years old. And you say, how do you know it's a fossil worm? It looks like a dead worm. Well preserved. In fact, I've got heaps of these in my collection. Fossil worms, dead worms. Of course, I don't believe that rock is 500 million years old anymore, but I do know one thing you can be dogmatic about. From the time that rock was laid down up to the present, worms have produced worms. And they still look exactly the same. Which means if you're asking questions like, hey, if Genesis is right, when it says God created things to produce their own kind, then worms should turn into some kind of worms. Which, by the way, is the only thing you've ever seen them do. Agree? I mean, David Attenborough says, and as the creature crawled out of the ocean, it turned into a bird. It's an evolutional phase. And not once does it show you any evidence whatsoever. Okay, what do you need to make a worm? How's your list going? You need the ground, you need the plants, you need water for the plants. And you might need to throw in some sunlight for the plants too, eh? Which means you need a sun or some source of light. How about this one? What do you need to keep a dinosaur alive? Aren't these interesting questions? Do you realise you live on a planet where you only get the answers to the questions that you ask? If you don't ask the right questions, don't expect the right answers. That, by the way, for any of you who are teachers, is one reason there's a verse in the Bible that says, don't let too many of you be teachers. Because teachers will be judged twice. Do you realise one of the easiest ways to brainwash a population is to make sure there's questions they cannot ask? Prove it. First year geology. Excuse me, sir. What would the evidence for Noah's flood be? Try it at Lancaster University. See how well you get responded to. Oh, what do you need to keep a dinosaur alive? Much simpler question, actually. See how good you are on recognition. Anyone know what they are? I found some good ones of these just recently. That's fossil poo. I mean, dogs do enough of it. It should be fossilised somewhere. And certainly, hang on, the dogs' ones are eaten by the worms. Isn't that true? And they disappear. But the rocks are full of dinosaur poo, and nobody asks why. In fact, the biggest piece of dinosaur poop is that one. That big, right? There's lots of dinosaur poop out there. I've got a lot of it. There's a piece, cut and polished. If you like it, that's a piece of polished petrified poo. Well, you notice the white marks? Now, stop a moment. What do you need to keep a dinosaur alive? Because dinosaurs are very big. And if you weigh 20 tons, then you eat a lot. And if you eat 2 tons a day at this end, guess what comes out the other end? Oh, you've never thought of that. You've never asked that question. Actually, I'm not surprised Jesus told people, you will love me with your heart, your soul, and your mind. You will think. Most of us don't. Oh, that's a piece of polished petrified poo, as I said before. And those white pieces are dung beetle burrows. Because, you see, the Bible says the same God who invented the front end of the dinosaur invented the rear end as well. And I know you don't get lectures on poop too often, so I have to make the most of this. The reality is, if you deposit 1 ton a day out that end, then if you don't have creatures to remove the poo, guess what happens after a month or two? You're up to there. No dungeons, no dinosaurs. We know about this in Australia because we bought cattle from England to Australia. You know, remember when they sent that bunch of people from England, free of charge, one-way ticket, no return please, to Australia? They sent cows as well. And for the first 70 years, we had to rake up all the cow poop. We did. And nobody knew why. Well, the answer is, we sent the cows, and the cows eat green grass at this end, and you white stuff in the middle, brown stuff at the other end, correct? And in Australia, for 70 years, they had to rake it up. In fact, we invented all sorts of things. The kids would play with the dried out cow poo. We invented frisbees and all sorts of things. Okay? No dung beetles was the clue. I've dung beetles. If you've ever wondered if God's got a great sense of humour, then think about the dung beetle. You don't see them operating because A, they're tiny, B, they're black, and C, they come out at night. And when you're fast asleep, up they come, and they say, oh, yummy, another big brown one. By the way, if you were creating a world, would you have thought of dung beetles? Because if you didn't, neither the cows nor the dinosaurs would do really well. Dung beetles are interesting. They're only tiny. And of course, they're called dung beetles because what do they eat? Yeah, eat the stuff. Amazing. Look at it. Tucking into it. And of course, he grabs a ball, rolls it up, takes it home, gives it to his girlfriend and said, here, marry me.
It worked for me.
Yeah. By the way, it really works. Look at all their kids. Okay. But even though you've learnt the biology of dung beetles in Zoology 3 at university or whatever, you've never asked why you need to keep a dung beetle alive. Or what do you need to keep a dinosaur alive? How does it all work when the worms and you name it? In fact, very few people ask these questions. Because I love telling students, you want a PhD, think of a question that's never been asked. There's millions of them out there. Ah, here's the dung beetle. He's coming out at night. Easy to find the dung because I find you any pile of dung you like. Question, if you're little and you're black and you can't see because you're so tiny, you find the dung easily, how do you find your way home? In the dark. Which way is home? Well, all the research that's been done is interesting. They don't come out in the daytime because if you're tiny and the dinosaur was big, you've had it. Okay, they come out at night. They can't be seen. And we've discovered how they actually find their way around. They actually do map the position of the sun and the moon. I mean, even when the sun sets, don't you get a glow on one side of the sky? So you know where west is for nearly half the night, and then you can take over from the morning light coming up. The moon is also a clue as well. In fact, the polarized light that's coming, you know, when light hits a surface, whether it's a cloud or a tree, the remaining rays are actually all turned into one plane. It's called polarized. For those of you who want a practical experience, get your very expensive Ray-Ban sunglasses. And if you have expensive sunglasses, there's a donation box up the back. We'd appreciate all that we can get. And what you do is you get two pairs, and you put one in front of the other, then you turn one of them right angles. and the lens will go black because the polarized light cannot get through two at different angles. Oh, and the polarized light, what do you call that light band going through the middle of the sky? Milky Way. And if you notice how the stars seem to move from our perspective, but the Milky Way actually stays in the same orientation, even though the whole thing seems to move, and the diminishing light from either side of it tells you exactly where you are if you know how to map it. There's a spectral gradient right across the sky. I mean, look at the poor little dumb beetle looking out at the sky. Yeah, you say, how do you know all of this? Well, that Milky Way actually maps its position as it's leaving, then puts all of that data together and finds its way exactly home. Come on, you can't be serious. Oh, yes, we can. Do you realise sometimes it's fun to be a scientist? As the little dung beetle comes out of his burrow, what you do is you photograph the sky just after he stood out there looking. And then immediately you project the sky onto a black sheet that you immediately put over there, and then you twist the picture. So the Milky Way is in a different place. The sun's in a different place. The moon, you know, he never finds his way home. And you say, fooled you again. Yeah, that's how you do it. And you can make him go wherever you like. You see, what do you need to keep the dung beetle alive? Well, the answer is dung. But in order to have dung, you need an animal that needs plants. In order to have plants, you need the worm. In order to have the worm, you need... You see where we're going? In fact, plants, water, and Mrs. Dung Beetle, when did you receive her ball of engagement? Should that be engagement ball, whatever it is. You can't stop there, because you actually need a mechanism to map the sky and a memory, and in order for that to happen, you need planet, light, sun, stars, and universe. All to have a dung beetle. I'm doing this deliberately because you and I have in our heads the David Attenborough, Alice Roberts, BBC, National Geographic, step by step, all by accident, over millions of years, and it can happen. And look what's happened. No, that is ridiculous. You can't simply do this step by step at all. So how are you going with that question? I mean, this is Word Knowledge 101. The test will be set at the end of it. And you'll find this very helpful, by the way, because we've now got to throw Earth into this. And you just can't have any sized Earth. Think it through. If it was too tiny, then the worm would float off. The water wouldn't stay. You've got to have air, you've got to have water, you've got to have bacteria, planets, space, etc. Well, you need to make a dinosaur. That's even harder. How about we hand out a sheet and say, write up all this? By the way, dinosaurs is our subject tomorrow night, and you will be fascinated not only how they got into the rocks, because I've done lots of dinosaur digs, but what happened to the ones that didn't get drowned? Noah's flood. You're talking about dinosaurs and Noah's flood? Yep, I am tomorrow night. You might have an answer to that question by then. But let's begin to sort of move into part two before we let you have some questions. What do you need to make a flower? Now, these flowers are from my backyard. I have a big pond down the back, and it's full of water lilies, which means it's obviously full of water. Aren't they beautiful flowers, by the way? And here's my question. How long can you take to make a water lily? Not just what you need to keep it alive, not just how do you make it, but how long can you take to make a water lily? They're beautiful things, aren't they? They truly, truly are. But you see, the average person has never stopped to think what fertilises them out in the middle of the pond. Now, my pond is about 70 metres, 80 yards long. It's a big pond. We use it for watering all of our property, etc. Australia has big droughts, so we need big water supplies that you have to make yourself so often. Okay, that's the water lily. You see the little insects that are in it? Now, anybody here who's an engineer or a medico, etc., will happily tell you that the smaller the insect or the smaller the creature, the bigger the surface area loss of heat. So if these little critters fly over cool water, they will actually lose heat incredibly rapidly. So why would they bother even flying out to a water lily when there's plenty of flowers up in the trees? Or if they're desperate and all the flowers in the trees have gone due to the drought, but there's still some water lilies in the pond. Look, they're packed with these things. Oh, you can say pollen and everything else, but it turns out to be a far more sophisticated answer. Well, one pond in my backyard, one water lily with some flies and bugs in it, only tiny, major heat loss. Yours truly, holding one thermometer. Note the air temperature, 26.2 degrees. Note the water temperature, 19.7 degrees. Are you ready for a shot? The flower temperature is 32.8. I know, they told you at school that only us and mammals can make themselves warm. Nonsense. Water lilies do it, they just do it in a different way. I mean, don't you buy biofuels today? Where we bought sugar off a sugar farm or cane sucrose or something and we've converted it into diesel fuel? Well, they do exactly the same. They make sugars, that's why the insects go there, but they don't let the insect have all their sugars. They actually take some and they break them up and turn them into fuel. And they heat themselves. Now, that's not really how you do it, but it's the way the water lilies do it. Or do you know why the insects fly after water lilies? It's a sauna bar. It's beautiful. They don't need to worry about heat loss. Oh, if there was no heat gain there, they would never make it across the pond. Run some tests yourself. Get 100 metres of water, start out with a little hungry fly at this end, and see how far it makes it backwards and forwards across the pond. What do you need to make a flower? How's your list go? Oh, you haven't even thought about how you get to be a water plant. Because you see, in Botany 205, they actually tell you that the plants started on the land and then they migrated into the water. Oh, before that, they used to be seaweed that didn't have flowers and they migrated onto the land. And it all sounds so, well, it's not logical, but it's consistent. Okay, do you realise if you actually tried to evolve from being a land plant to a water plant, you have one major hiccup, apart from the flowers and the bees? Here's the major hiccup. Haven't you looked at a leaf and noticed on land plants the little holes that breathe through are on the bottom of the leaf? They are. Plants do breathe. The oxygen comes in, the CO2 comes in, the CO2 comes out, the oxygen comes out, depending on whether it's day or night, and they breathe. Have you tried breathing with your nose underwater? Because if you were a land plant with your breathing holes on the bottom of the leaf and you went into the water, your next step is drown dead. Water lilies have all their breathing holes on the top of the leaf. Isn't that interesting? I mean, you never thought of that, neither did your teacher tell about it, and David Attenborough never mentions it, and Brian Cox ignores it totally. You see, what do you need to make a flower? Particularly water lily, you need water. But in order to make a water lily, you actually need a plant that's big enough so the water won't float away. And in order for the water lily to work, you actually need insects that can detect colour. Because why didn't they land on the leaf? They actually have to know what they're after. I mean, why aren't all the flowers black? Well, if they were, the insects wouldn't go there. It's interesting in this world. You live in a world in which if you want an organisation to work, cooperation really is a viable situation. But it's actually the whole parameter that's out there in the real world. You can't have A unless you have B, and B doesn't work unless you have C, and C, by the time you get all around, won't work unless you have A. Nothing in the living world works in isolation. There's an interesting point in Genesis. It says, God made the plants so they were beautiful to the eyes. Now, I think you'll probably agree, particularly ladies who get a bunch of flowers on Mother's Day, or your boyfriend gives you a new orchid, and you just react and say, isn't that lovely? Do you realise that evolutionist true beauty has no place at all? It has no purpose whatsoever. Nothing is achieving anything by being beautiful. I mean, maybe it will just be a purple, silly, flat thing with a bunch of pollen in the middle, sitting on a green thing in the middle of the water. Why make it beautiful? The Bible says God made these things functioning, and functioning includes you reacting to it as well. So that you decide, hey, I'm going to make a water lily garden. And look how beautiful it actually is. Did you catch this warning on October 18th? A study done in Germany, warning of ecological Armageddon. I find it interesting that The Guardian, a left-wing non-Christian newspaper, actually borrows phrases from the Bible. Ecological Armageddon. Armageddon, the last big battle mentioned in the book of Revelation. Yeah, when God, who created the world, is coming back to judge the world rightly. And Armageddon is tucked in there just before the end. Okay, after a dramatic plunge in insect numbers, You say, what are they worried about? Well, they got volunteers in Germany to take specially organised little kits and count the number of insects all over Germany. And they discovered that 3/4 of the insects have disappeared since the last study was done 25 years ago. And they're worried. No insects? What happens to your apple crop? I mean, you could play B if you like and go around fertilising all the apple trees, but the price of apples would go through the top of the house. And they're really concerned. No insects, no roses, no fruits. In fact, they're worried about life on Earth disappearing. It's amazing that they can see the connection with the insects. I don't, by the way, think this applies to England yet. The study was only done in Germany, but the Guardian is blaming us for everything and applying it to England. And all tied into climate change and, you know, all those sort of political scenarios. Okay, let's get to a few punchlines here. Brian Cox says you can actually make flowers millions and millions of years after you make seaweed. Oh, but you didn't make seaweed, it just happened by itself. And insects somehow evolved all by themselves. Somehow it all works, even though it all happened by chance. The Bible says, no, it didn't happen by chance. God made the plants, the grasses, the flowering things, the fruit trees, etc. on the third day, and the evening and the morning were the third day, says the book of Genesis, and he made the flying things, the fertilizing things, on the fifth day. Now, if you're like me, I struggled a lot with these days because I had millions of years in my head until I actually said, okay, I'm a geologist, I dig up dead things, I'm going to go and study genetics and find out about living things. And I've always been a gardener, and the one thing I've discovered is if I want my flowers to flower, then I need the bees there at the same time. If I want my flowers to work, I need the water at the same time. I need the worms at the same time. And it all has to work so incredibly well. In fact, I grow orchids, as some of you know, and there are certain orchids that I grow which are only fertilised by one sex of one species of bee. You know why? It's the only one that fits in the slot. They just fit like that. No other bee will fit there. And you think, that's impressive. And I have some orchids that are only fertilised by mosquitoes. And I know you thought mosquitoes don't do anything to bite people. No. They fertilise plants brilliantly. Okay, how long have you got to make a flower? How long have you got to make this whole system work? You see, that's the end statement of Genesis. For those of you who struggle with the days, are they thousands of years? Are they millions of years? Can you add evolution? Not if you want the flowers to work. Because you see, if you want to read Genesis in any way, shape or form to give it any integrity, then you have to face up to the fact that says God made plants on the third day. There was only one day after that, on the fifth day, just a gap of one day, when he made the first creatures that could pollinate them. You try and stretch that out into, well, some Christians say the days are 1,000 years, don't they? Can I warn you? If you have the plants on one day, and 1,000 years later you have the insects, tell me what's happened to the plants. They've all died. And as soon as the insects come and they have nothing to eat, tell me what happened to the insects. And therein lies the problem with Brian Cox and Alice Roberts and the BBC. They're talking nonsense. In fact, we'll get to Brian Cox again right at the end to give you a shot in the eye to sort of stimulate you to ask me a few questions. How long have you got to make a flower? Wrong question. Time never makes a flower work. Process does. And the process has to include all the things that you need to actually make the flower and work and make it survive and make it reproduce so it doesn't die out. And there's a stumbling block. God made it all in 6 days. Tomorrow morning I'm going to speak about that specifically because I got a question from a missionary a couple of years ago now, just after I was here last time, and he put his hand up right at the end of a public meeting and said, well, this is all very interesting, but does any New Testament doctrine depend on the 6 days? I thought, that's a very good question. So we're going to be looking tomorrow morning at not just the evidence, but that biblical question too. And for those of you who come here, you'll find that a great time. And tomorrow night, we'll have more on the dinosaurs. So let me give you one last question. What do you need to keep a man alive? Because the Bible says he was made on the sixth day. Oh, this is James, by the way. We're at our Outdoor Creation Museum in Australia. And James has just been erecting, can you see a petrified tree here? This is the world's first and only petrified sundial. Yeah, 3 to go. Oh, and James is out over there. Look, he's just erected a dinosaur skull. And the kids come along here because they love dinosaurs. That's why it'll be here tomorrow night, isn't it? The big kids love dinosaurs too. But almost nobody asks, what do you keep in to keep a man alive? When we first invented this, see all the fossils here that come from our Jurassic Ark site? It was fascinating listening to the students. Because the students actually had never seen a sundial in Australia before. Not a petrified tree one. And the, how does it work? And you see the yellow marks? They're the hours. Sundials work because the sun of the universe works like clockwork. It really does. Then I had one kid who said, well, it works in the daytime. How does it work at night? I thought, good question. Until his friend said, don't be stupid, you use a torch. by the way, what do you need to keep a man alive? The answer is, you don't need dinosaurs, correct? You're doing quite well without them. So there's some things that are not needed to keep a man alive. And to give you a practical illustration of this, I was in Wundig High School, and the principal was a bit antsy at me having been invited in by the science department, and so he said to me, you can't bring religion into this group. I had several hundred year 12 science students. He said, you do not bring the Bible into this. I said, well, that's all right. Do you mind if I ask them a question? Okay, what's your question? So I wrote it up on the whiteboard. What 5 things do you need to keep a man alive? And I said to the students, okay, talk for 10 minutes, and then at the end of 10 minutes, I want to hear your answers. Now, they thought this was pretty good. After 10 minutes, they were obviously involved in this, and I said, what 5 things do you need to keep a man alive? Sir, you need air to breathe. Okay, we're right up there. What else do you need? Well, you need food. Okay, what sort of food? 21st century kids, vegetables. They're all vegans. Air, plants. you need water to drink. Okay, air, plants, water. What else? Well, you need light so you can see what food you're eating. Okay, that's 4 things. What's the fifth thing? Sex. Sex. Okay, right up, sex. And then I said, I can see only one problem. Where is this man? And they said, he's anywhere. I said, no, he can't just be anywhere. Where is he? Well, he's on a planet. I said, what kind of planet? Any planet. I said, nah, you put him on Jupiter, he'll squash flat. You put him on Mercury, he'll probably float away. Well, a planet about this size, sir. Okay. I said, where is this planet? Oh, it's in space. I said, well, do you need the space first, or do you need the planet first? Oh, you can't have a planet unless you've got some space first. Okay, so let's write this up. Heavens, Earth. Okay. I said, well, what about these plants? Do you need the plants before the man, or the man, why do you need the plants before the man? Okay, so heaven, earth, plants. I said, hang on, do you need the water before the plants, or the plants before the plant? You've got to have the water first, or the plants won't grow. Heaven, earth, water, plants. I said, well, what about the light? Do you need the light before or after? You've got to have the light first. Heaven, earth, water, lights, plants. I said, what about this sex business? Do you need the sex before or after the man? Well, you don't have a man, there's no point in having sex, is there? Okay, so heavens, earth, water, plants, water, light, plants, man, woman. By that time, the headmaster is getting really annoyed. Because he has just recognized something that most of the students didn't. I have just rewritten Genesis chapter 1. Because there is no other way you can actually do it to make it work. Ryan Cox will never even admit that, because he knows it says in Genesis, God made the world in 6 days, because he writes books about me and some of the others, and he says, I can't stand people who believe the world's made in 6 days. In fact, he even wrote a book called How to Make a Universe. You'd think he was an authority. And many of you, of course, are a bit afraid to tackle people like Cox. And, he's a professor of physics. I mean, these guys have got to be pretty smart. By the way, smart is not the same as wise. Wisdom always defeats IQ every time. Trust me. You see, if you were tackling Brian Cox on this, how would you do it? Don't worry about the PhD or your Big Bang theories or anything. Simply ask one very practical question. Okay, Professor Cox, you don't believe God can make a world in just 6 days, correct? No. Question, Mr. Cox, when was the last time you made a universe? Well, I've never made the universe. Do you realise that makes you absolutely incompetent to tell me how long it takes to make one? I mean, that's so simple, but it happens to be the truth. So very, very practical. Well, I'm going to stop there. Someone's going to bring me a mouthful of water, because the speaker needs a mouthful of water, and I'd encourage you to do that. You're going to have a chance to think about the questions there. You're also going to be warned that up the back on the table, Ed and his daughter, one of our trust members, who's here, who will sort of be behind the table with me up there, I trust. You can actually see the display, but we have a newsletter form. They'll be out all weekend, tonight and tomorrow. And as I said, we support AIG and that, or we're different organisations. If you want to keep in touch with what's happening with our museums here in the UK and the young workers who are joining us, then I'd encourage you to sign up. It's free, and free is a very good Penrith price. So you would enjoy getting that. If you have a look at the DVDs, there's quite a few up there. Some, like this one, have been so popular we've run out. But don't forget, they are available as MP4s, or order them from the web shop, etc. Let me grab a mouthful of water. Okay, anyone got any questions on what we have done so far? Your chance. Yes?
I have a question. You mentioned there were lions up there, and you were saying all animals used to be herbivorous.
Yeah.
I've often had a question about that. I mean, I'm a creationist, but I've often wondered, you mentioned ecosystems. Isn't it possible that we're talking about the plants as the foundation of the ecosystem, and we didn't, you don't have to be committed to all these animals being created vegetarian?
Well, you simply do, because God told Adam that all the creatures he had made would eat plants. Right, so Genesis 1, 26 onwards is emphatic that all the creatures ate plants. Just as it's emphatic that when Christ comes back, the lion will once again lay down with the ox, and they'll both eat straw, just like the cattle, etc. There will be coming a time again when there will be no death or destruction when Christ returns. So it is an emphatic, important bit in the beginning, and that's why the world is good. I was in India a little while ago, and it's a tragic place. There's so much debt in the streets. There's so much hunger. The animals, like one night I was staying in my accommodation, and there's dogs by the gazillion in India eating all the rubbish and the refuse and the dead bodies. That at night they'll sort of retreat to the edge of the jungle, and the lions or the animals will get them, and they'll eat. And rip, 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 and that's the end of the dog. And it doesn't make you feel happy. Right? It's a tragic world that we live in. So a world absent death and struggle and suffering is an imperative in Genesis chapter 1. The thing that helped me a lot with this was to think through several issues. And the first one is, why do I believe animals with sharp teeth have to be killers? And the answer is, that's what my biology lecturer told me. I used to teach that myself until I sat down and thought, well, is this actually true, or is it just generally believed to be true? I was staying on a blueberry farm in the USA one year, and the farmer looked out the window and said, oh no, the cats are raiding the blueberries. Cats are raiding the blueberries. I looked out, sure enough, the cats were raiding the blueberries. When I did a little bit further investigation, I discovered one thing. There's the cat's teeth. We see the sharp points as being what it uses, but not to get blueberries. It rakes the branches with the spaces between its teeth. So we do that with rakes. Right? Now, you can use a rake as a weapon, but in reality, we use the spaces. And so does the animal with a sharp tooth, and it will rake all the berries off and go, They love blueberries. And the scripture says the foxes raid the grapes. Now, I have a big, massive cross dog, right? Brilliant for keeping Jehovah's Witnesses. So what you find is my big massive cross, his jaw is incredibly powerful. I mean, they really have several hundred pound pressure in their jaw, but he loves eating mangoes. But he doesn't eat the flesh. Now, mangoes are a lovely big tropical fruit. You don't see them growing over here. You can buy them occasionally, but they're nowhere near as nice as getting them straight off the tree. And he waits till they drop on the ground, and then he tears the flesh off. But what he's after is the big, thick, really hard, you almost need a machete to chop into the seed, But inside that leather case is a highly protein-rich kernel. And that's what he's after. So he uses his massive jaws to tear the pieces up, and then he gets the nice, very strong, rich protein in the middle. So, number one, the perceived function may be a secondary function, not a primary one. Let me give you an illustration of that. When you think of the T Model Ford, Henry Ford designs the production line, and the T Model Ford comes into operation designed to carry people and carry goods, and it does it beautifully. Okay, we're now 100 and something years further down from the invention of the Ford production line. Statistically, you could prove the Ford was designed to kill children. But it doesn't. It was never designed for that. Don't blame Henry Ford for that. Blame drunk drivers, careless mechanics, city kids, wet roads, oil spills, all the above, but not the designer of the car. Likewise, remember in 9/11 in the USA when the terrorists took down those planes? And you say, how did they capture the planes? The answer is the harmless little Napoleon knife. It didn't show up as a weapon. I mean, they've got a blade this long, right? And it slides out. You can still buy them, but you can't carry them on planes anymore. Right? And what they did was they took an implement designed for a very good purpose, and then they slit the throats of the stewardesses. And you think, I wouldn't have thought of that. Well, the man who designed it didn't think of that. An evil person took a good thing and made it achieve something bad. And so what you find is if you look through the history of the world, Genesis says God made the world good, and the moral of the story is don't blame him for anything rotten. Keep reading. Genesis chapter 3, we blew it. Genesis chapter 4 and onwards, a sad history of death. There's murder in chapter 4. But by the time you get past Noah, carnivores rob the planet. No carnivores before the flood. Joseph is dropped into a well, sold off to the slaves, and his brothers say, well, then tell Dad. And the youngest one asked the question. The oldest one said, soak his coat in blood and tell Dad a wild animal ate him. So by the days of Joseph, his father knew of people who had been killed by wild animals. So you go from vegetarian to scavengers to carnivores, now to a world of kill or be killed. And if Brian Fox and Alice Roberts and Attenborough are making any mistake at saying what it's like now, it always was. And the Bible says, no, look where it started. Look how far you've fallen. Look how much you need me. There's a course out the front on that door that means, well, you know, you need an image improvement, you need to lose weight, get on board the health, etc. But they're concentrating on the wrong image. The image that's really lost is God's image in man because of sin. And that's what produces terrorists who actually cut you with the arms of a linoleum knife. And the same is true for animals. If you have a look at most animals with sharp teeth, you actually find, well, my dogs can be vegetarian if they want to be, just if they don't want to be. And I like my steak, and I'm really glad God gave permission that we could eat it, but you don't have to. Right? So what you find is, by the way, if you like your meat, don't think it makes you live any longer. Up to Noah's day, we lived to be nearly 1,000. After that, McDonald's has increasingly decreased our life. Okay, anybody else have any questions? Elijah, yes, sir?
I've got several, but I'll ask you one. How long do you think it was before Adam and Eve sinned? How long do you think from God making Adam and Eve, mm-hmm. sinned, how long do you think?
Good question. You read first about Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 1 and 2. In Genesis chapter 3, they sin. In Genesis chapter 4, it says, and Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived, and she brought forth a son, and she brought forth a second one, right? And so it came Abel on the planet. What you find next is it says, now Cain was a farmer of vegetables, and Abel was a herdsman. They jumped 20 years in one verse. All right, so how long were Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden? Okay, Genesis chapter 1 and 2, God made the world very good. He made Adam and Eve on the sixth day. Then God rested on the seventh. Notice this wasn't Adam and Eve's seventh day. They were only one day old. They didn't need to rest at all. They hadn't done any work yet. But God rested on that seventh day. Okay, then on the next day, when the world had been made, Adam and Eve must be there, right? Because God rested on the Sabbath. We see that in Exodus chapter 20. It's celebrated as an ordinary day, particularly for the people of Israel. And then you find an interesting thing. God has already given Adam and Eve two commandments. Okay, one is, you will not eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They broke that one in Genesis chapter 3. But in Genesis chapter 2, they'd been given a second command. And the commandment was multiply and fill the earth. Now, as non-sinners, the one thing they would have done is obey God's instruction. Eve was not pregnant. Therefore, it was probably less than 3 weeks that they were in the Garden of Eden. Any of you young kids who need to know why I said 3 weeks, talk to your mum and dad. Right, so what you find is there's no evidence of a long period of time, hundreds of years, because simply she wasn't pregnant. Likewise, you'll also find Adam was created on the sixth day and is recorded as dying when he's 930 years old. Right? If he'd been there for thousands of years, that would have been a fallacious statement. Right? So he was there for a very short period. Eve was there for a very short period of time. Okay, if you put more money in the offering, you can ask the second question. What's your second one? How do you think dinosaurs disappeared? Can you come back tomorrow night?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Controversial. There's one up there we hadn't done when I was here last, called The Real History of Worms and Germs. There's two parts on this DVD. I'm on the first part, and there's another scientist on the second part. You'll enjoy both of them. One deals with the evidence of God's genius as designer. One deals with what happened to the design since Adam sinned, particularly when it comes to worms and germs. Remember now, we started with worms. You want to see what happens when a problem of moral degradation even affects the worm. Do you have a question up there? Yes.
Yeah, in the National Geographic and in the BBC this week, there's an article talking about this found new teeth. I don't know if you're aware of that, or but basically these teeth of a rat-like creature, but the problem is they found it in rock, which was 145 million years before mammals were supposed to evolve. So the conclusion they came to is they're going to have to rewrite the whole history of evolving mammals, and from this creature came whales and man and you name it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my question is, what would be your take on things like that in terms of the reason all they've got to go on is two teeth that they created an animal from, an imaginary animal from, and they've said that they know that it's that old because it's in that rock. So in terms of the dating rock, what would you say?
Well, Mark Twain, the American, you may remember, he wrote lots of books in the late 1800s. Mark Twain had an interesting comment on the theory of evolution. He called it imagination unfettered by facts. Right, so if you start off with a picture of millions of years of evolution and a picture of how the rocks formed when you weren't there to observe either, then all of a sudden you'll come across evidence which doesn't fit your story, so you have to retell the story so that you try and keep one rule constant: God doesn't fit into it. I say that because if you look up your science teacher's journal here in November 2003, there's an article on what science is. Quote unquote, science is any naturalistic explanation without reference to God. So it doesn't matter what the story used to be or what the next story will be, the one thing you can guarantee is that God won't get a look into it at all. Because what they're trying to do is explain how whales used to be cows that went back into the water, but they came from this other creature that stood on the land, but this new creature doesn't fit their old story, so they'll rejuggle the story. For those of you who don't know anything about dating rocks, here in England you have a history which involves the very basics of understanding geology. The word geology was invented by the Bishop of Durham in the 1300s. He believed in 6 days of creation, he believed in Noah's flood. Your first geologic map in the world was printed here in England. It was the results of a canal builder, William Smith, who actually believed in 6 days of creation and Noah's flood. And you will find that he actually observed, if I'm going to make canals all around England, the best place is to have it in waterproof rocks, right? You don't want the water to run away. So therefore, when they studied the rocks they were going to use, and later on when William Smith invents the actual steam train, you will find that you have to drill holes through rocks. So you need to know what rocks will hold and how strong they are. So they discovered a rule. On this side of the hill, if there's fossil X, Y, and Z, and you get the same fossils on the other side, then it's highly probable that the rock goes all the way through. Right? So you can tell a rock by the kind of fossil that's in it. Now, that is true all over the planet. It's why when I came down from the highlands yesterday, I've been up at Glora, and the rocks there are called Jurassic. You say, why are they called Jurassic? Because they're 100 million years old? No, they're called Jurassic because they're like the rocks in the Jura Mountains. Who invented the concept Jurassic? A six-day Noah's flood believing creationist by the name of Alexander von Humboldt, who was a famous geographer. You might have heard of the Humboldt Current. But they never tell you these guys had no concept of evolution or millions of years at all. Here's what happened next. You have a Scotsman by the name of Charles Lyell, who becomes Charles Darwin's mentor, who modifies the rule a little bit. You can tell a rock by the fossil exhibit. That turns out to be true. He went and said, you can tell the age of a rock by the fossils that are in it. So if we arrange the fossils in order from simple to complex, and then say this matches the history of life, and then say, how long does it take A to turn into B? And Darwin says, 20 million years. Okay, I've got 12 layers, 12 times 20 is 240. And as much as you think I'm not making this up, this is exactly what happened. So the fossils became measures of the age of the rock. And then they wrote their story one on the basis of this order of fossils. And then someone comes along and says, oh, but I found this fossil here. Or change the story, don't tell about it. I know that's true because I went to Queensland University to do geology, and my house is built on certain rocks. Okay, let me tell you the history of these rocks. When I was a student, they were 500 to 600 million years of age. Why? Because nobody had found any fossils in them. Then, a young student on the north side of town found what was the remains of a trilobite on the north side of town in the same rocks. So all of a sudden, they were 600 million years of age. And then, when I was almost finished my study, a student wrote a doctoral thesis on discovering a crinoid fragment, that's a sort of like a cedar leaf, in a piece of rock that was blown out from a volcano that probably came from the rock my house was built on. Right? And all of a sudden, they were 300 million years ago. Now, my poor house is totally confused by this. But the point is, no one cares less what the radioactive dates are. It always goes by the fossils, and I'll guarantee there isn't a single student at Queensland University who knows this rock has had three ages in the past 40 years. Just like all of the rocks in England have been dated and redated and redated, and they just change it to fit whatever the currency is. Okay, that sort of helps. One last question.
How reliable is carbon dating?
How reliable is carbon dating? You'll find the same rule I just gave you about the fossils is the governing factor. So if you want to know whether it works or not, find one fossil and actually chop it into 10, then send it to 10 different laboratories, but don't tell them where it came from. And what you'll discover is you get at least 10 different results. It costs you several hundred pounds a time, so this is an expensive operation to achieve. If you want to help us do more, then you can do donate through the trust, etc. But it's very embarrassing for them because most people think this is rock-solid evaluation, rock-solid evidence. In reality, it simply depends on the laboratory and on correlating with previous dates for that sort of thing. So it's not a reliable method at all. The closer you get to the present, the more reliable it seems to come. Right, so if you dated something 1,000 years of age, then 2,000, then 3,000, you find the further back you go, the further the date gets from any historical record. And I suspect the reason is what we call carbon-14 didn't actually come into function until after Noah's flood. And the way the maths works means that the closer you get to the present, the more it's approaching what we call equilibrium. Now, for those of you who aren't maths, you know what equilibrium is because you learned at school. 3 plus 7 equals 10. That's equilibrium, right? So carbon-14 works if the maths this side and the maths that side actually match up. It's forming in the world. It's falling apart. If the two sides don't match, then it's fudgeland. And the trouble is you live in a world where the amount that's forming and the amount that's falling to pieces actually happen to disagree. They are not the same. No one's ever measured them the same. So there's the real weakness in the carbon-14 dating system. Again, I suspect it happened only when the sky fell down and extra radiation could come in from outer space and begin to form. Okay, let me just finish off with one challenge. I picked the ESV version here because it's one of the easiest ones to understand, where the Apostle Paul, talking to the Church of Corinth, do you realise the Church of Corinth and the Church in England got a lot in common? Do you go to gymnasiums at school? Gymnasium's a Greek word. Corinth was in Greek. The people he's writing to are not Jews. They're Greek thinkers like you and I are. Greek thinkers think the alphabet begins at A and it finishes at Z. And everything flows on from A to B to C to D. I mean, why? Why do you think that? Why do you go to a gymnasium? Anybody know what the word gymnasium means? Because in Europe, some schools are called gymnasiums. Gymnasium means run around naked. Isn't that what they did in ancient? It does. It really does. You see, when they held the Olympic Games, the women weren't allowed to go because the men were running around naked. And what Paul is facing here is a church that's not Greek, not Jewish in its thinking. It's very Greek. Because of A, therefore B. Because of B, therefore C. And in fact, Paul often tells them, have a reason for what you believe, etc. Make sure you test everything. When you read the Gospel of Luke, it's interesting. Luke was a Greek, and he writes totally different than all the Jewish philosophers, except for Paul, who understands them both. What you find is Luke says, I've gone to all the trouble to go to all the eyewitness accounts, so you might know for sure. Then he signs his name and says, here's what I've written before. Go and grab your classical Greek historians, and they start exactly the same way when they're telling you a history of Athens or whatever. And Paul says, we destroy arguments. Why? Because if you think this, you won't understand that. We destroy arguments, every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God, and take every thought captive to obey Christ. Now, this is my church lady, bless her heart. Now she wants to get both. She's willing to absorb all homosexuality in the UK. Isn't that true? That's not what she was elected on. I mean, I know enough about England politics to know that. Are you brave enough to destroy your argument? I mean, what is your argument? Why would you be pro-homosexual? Well, you see, you live in a world in which Corinth had heaps of homosexuals. Nothing new about homosexuality. And the reason's always been the same. You see, the Greeks had their own version of evolution. I mean, when Paul was speaking to the people in Acts 17 on Mars Hill, the academics, he was talking to a group of men who thought they evolved from slime. Yep. They had their own version of evolution. And they were very racist about it. Greek slime is higher quality than Jewish slime. So Paul said, no way. We are all made by the one creator. And we all come from the one man. And therefore this message is for the Greeks as well as it is for the Gentiles as it is for the Jews. We destroy arguments. Your Greek argument, evolution, forget it. It's nonsense. I have to destroy your argument. You see, when you have a look at your Bible, it's designed for minds like yours and mine. You and I have a lot of thoughts that actually are false. We're influenced by David Attenborough. We're influenced by the BBC. We're influenced by millions of years, and we don't even stop to see, hey, sharp teeth could be used for puncturing fruit. I mean, we have a creature in Australia that goes around killing bananas and oranges. The farmers hate it. It's got razor sharp teeth. It's 100% vegetarian, and it's called a fruit bat. And not once does it come up in your biology course as a reason for having sharp teeth. We destroy arguments. I'm not popular, by the way, when I bring up things like that. I'm not popular. I go, Mr. Dawkins, you're a fool. By the way, are you brave enough to tell people? Isn't that what the Bible says? Call fools fools?
Yeah.
Oh, I tell you what. You want to be low on the popularity rating? Do that. We destroy arguments. And every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God, and take thought every captive to obey Christ. If you're a Christian here tonight, can I challenge you to do that? Because it would mean that you would have to go to Mrs. May and say, Mrs. May, have you thought what's going to happen? You may have forgiven, you may have apologised to all the gays. Have you thought what God's going to say to you on judgment day? Because he's not going to look you in favour in any way, shape or form. I need to warn you because I love you. Hey, there's the crunch line, isn't it? Okay, we destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God, who is the creator, who made the world in 6 days, which is why he can destroy it like that. And judgment is coming. For all of us here who may not be Christians, get to the point that I got to and realise, hey, I'm not going to be judging on my professors, I'm going to be judged by the living God who made the world in just 6 days and can destroy it in less than 6 seconds. And I want to be in on the new creation and the new heavens and the new earth. And I'd encourage you to sit through that again. Tomorrow, what time do we meet here?
10:30.
10:30 in the evening.
6:30.
Bring your friends and your enemies tomorrow night. And dinosaurs, and our friend up the back is his third free question. And that will happen to the dinosaurs that we've got off Noah's Ark. Back to you, sir, to close the evening and tell us all about STEM. Oh, I did have one other thing I forgot to tell you. We have a fancy electronic credit card machine, but it broke. So I managed to rescue off the ark one of those old Ziploc machines. I know some of you have never seen one in your life. Come and see one. Get your credit card out, or credit card works. Are you in for